You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Nick, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Blake?
I'm really well. You've had a big weekend.
I have.
You've had a great weekend.
It has been a great weekend.
What happened?
It was the grand final.
The grand final of what?
Of my cricket team.
And?
And we won with three balls to spare.
Three balls to spare. Yep. It came down to the death knock.
Yep. And there was a couple of other players. There was a lot of games being played at different grounds. Yep. A call came into one of the other games at the under-14s where one of our sometimes fill-in players was scoring. A call came into him and said, one of the seniors players has broken down in the team. You got to get your whites on. You got to head out to Baldwin where we were playing.
Was it you?
And yes, it was me.
Oh, you'd broken down.
So I was just finishing off my eight-over spell. In limited overs, you can bowl eight overs.
Yeah.
And I had an over and a half to go.
Yeah.
Captain said, are you okay, Nick? And I've gone, I'm cooked, but I'll get through this. So I finished off. Pricey turned up and took over. Pricey's 13 years older than me, so he found it quite amusing that the kid broke down.
What's wrong with you?
Everything. I think a full season. I hadn't played a full season of cricket in 20 years, so the body is cooked.
It is amazing. The head still says,
oh, it's so competitive.
I'm going to charge in at a million off the long run, 35-step long run, come in, bowl at a million miles an hour. But in reality, if you had a video on you, in reality, it's a short run up.
No, I went the very short run this weekend because I knew that I was in a bit of trouble after doing a bit of hamstring strain the week before.
Mm.
So, but when you're in finals,
you just push through.
You don't get a chance to win a grand final very often.
And you won the grand final. And what were the celebrations like? So we
are massive.
So to our listeners, we're recording on a Monday morning. The grand final.
It concluded yesterday. We got a whole heap of rain on Saturday. We played a bit of the game then, played the rest on Sunday.
So have you been home?
Yeah, it's not quite as mad as you're expecting.
It's not Mad Monday on for the AFL.
It's not.
A couple of beers with a couple of old blokes.
No. So I need to book in to see some professionals this week to start the repair process on the body.
Funny you might say that.
Yeah?
Look at this for an amazing segue. We have an amazing guest today who, amongst one of the more diverse types of sports that she plays, she's also an exercise physiologist. Who are we talking to?
This week, episode 34, it's Lauren Foote, who, yes, exercise physiologist and world champion roller derby player.
Let's just repeat that. World champion roller derby player. How many times have you seen a roller derby game?
Well, prior to talking to Lauren, not many times, but I've looked at quite a bit of it on the interwebs.
Yeah.
And oh my God, that would if I'm cooked now, I don't know what would happen. And as you'll hear in this episode, Lauren challenges me to get on the roller skates. And I think the way my body's feeling right now, probably not going to happen anytime soon. Sorry, Lauren.
Yeah. Hey, this one is going to absolutely fill you with joy. Lauren Foote, what an amazing young lady. And she's
fantastic.
Just a delight from the moment we opened up the front door to the studio and in she wandered. And let's hear from her.
Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say,
do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Hey, Lauren. Welcome to the Doolanders. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. How are you, Nick?
I'm good. Thanks, Blake.
That is good.
How are you? Now we've completed the triangle.
Yeah, look, I'm really well.
Everyone's good.
We're all good. And we're super excited to be talking to you. Lauren, tell us, what do you do?
I am a roller derby player and also a exercise physiologist.
All right, let's start with the easier one first. What does an exercise physiologist do?
So exercise physiologists, or EPs, are fairly similar to physiotherapists, except rather than doing sort of hands-on treatment, we do sort of movement and exercise treatment for a range of different chronic health conditions.
Cool. So for a couple of old guys like us, you've got a whole heap of tips.
No, there's no hope.
Wow. You've met us like 10 minutes ago and you've nailed it in one. You're exactly right. There is no hope for us.
Beyond repair.
It does sound fascinating, but we sort of really care most about the roller derby. Like, for the uninitiated, what is roller derby and what's the point of the sport? What are you aiming at? What are you trying to achieve, the object of the sport?
So roller derby is a very fun sport, why I play it. It's played on an oval-shaped flat track on concrete or wood, and you've got sort of two key positions. So blockers sort of stand in a bit of a rugby scrum, or they create a bit of like a triangle, and everyone's rolling forwards on the track. And then you've got two point scorers and they're called jammers, and you can see who they are because they've got a star on their helmet. And the job of the jammers is to get as many laps as they can through that blocking defence or rugby scrum, whatever you want to call it, within 2 minutes sort of jams, as we call it.
Right.
And whoever gets the most points wins.
And how long does the actual game go for?
So 2 30-minute halves.
So for an hour, you are basically trying to block people from getting the jammers, or from stopping the jammers doing laps of the ring.
Yeah, that's right. So the reason I love it, A, it's on roller skates, so it's super fun.
Yeah.
But B, it's a really strategic game. So as a blocker, you need to decide constantly, am I going to help my jammer get through or stop the other jammer, or can I do both at the same time? So it's a really fun game in terms of we come up with heaps of sort of strategy and ideas, and sometimes we say two people do offense, two people do defense, or everyone let's lock down on this jammer, they're really good. So it's a really fun kind of strategic game, and, you know, you're on roller skates, which is a bonus.
Sounds cool. Can you slingshot the jammer?
You can actually. So there's a move called the whip.
The whip.
And, you can sort of push them through. Sometimes they fall over.
Right.
Or you can sort of, you know, whip them around by having your hand behind you and pulling them through. So there's lots of different ways to get your jammer through and get them all the points.
So, and well, if you're watching it for the first time, because there's a Netflix documentary on this sport as well, I think, isn't there?
Not at this stage, I don't think, but there might be something coming through.
I saw it on ATV.
Oh, yeah.
And if you just watch it without any commentary, it looks like there are no rules. It is just hit and slam. Are there rules to this sport?
Yes, there's lots of rules. It's very chaotic. And back in the day when it was sort of first born in Texas, it had a real wrestling kind of theatrical vibe to it. So I think when a lot of people think of roller derby, they have homage to that view of it, of like people with chairs, you know, hitting one another and tripping each other over and clotheslining each other. However, there's a lot of rules similar to AFL. So you can't get someone in the back, you can't trip someone, you can't get them sort of in the neck or anything. You can't physically tackle them, but you can hip and shoulder them, and you can sort of hit them or hit them in the chest. The rules are, though, that you sort of always need to be moving in a derby direction,
right.
So which is the counterclockwise. So you can't sort of run into someone who's running into you. Kind of that's a big no-no.
Right, okay. So you can't come at them from the opposite direction. So you're all going in the one direction.
That's
so
right.
There's a lot of, I imagine, side bumping and...
Yeah, yeah. Right. So you can go as slow as you like. So you can sort of just stand there and move your feet, and that's technically moving forward. So the aim might be, if I hit someone out of track, I can actually run backwards and they have to yield in behind me. So that's a really common strategy, is to hit someone out of play and then draw them back.
Right.
They can't sort of enter an advantage, or they get a cut track. And if you get a penalty, there's kind of lots of them, elbows, forearms, low block, tripping, whatever it might be. You have to sit in the penalty box, similar to ice hockey, for 30 seconds.
Right. How many umpires?
Oh, there's so many referees. Seven per game.
Seven?
Yeah, almost as many as there are players. I'm pretty sure, I could be wrong, an official will probably tell me I'm wrong, but yes, heaps of referees. There's one designated just for the jammer. So if you're jamming, you got to build a bit of a relationship up with them. And then there's pack referees, front of pack, back pack, outside referees. So quite a lot watching and making sure we're not doing anything wrong.
What's your specialty? Are you a blocker or a jammer, or are you that good you can do both?
I like to play both. I've got most experience blocking, and then even within blocking there's different positions. So I like bracing, which is when you skate backwards and you hold together your forwards-facing blockers in sort of like a triangle shape.
Yeah.
Which means you need to have skill set in skating backwards and being able to catch players as they hit you in the chest.
Yeah.
And then a few years ago, I got asked to give jamming a bit of a go. So I'm pretty lucky that I've been able to kind of develop skills in both roles.
Yeah. What makes a great player?
The thing I love about roller derby is you can't really look at anyone and determine if they're a great player or not. And even some of the traits that are probably sensationalised in other sports are really different in derby. So, for example, if you see a player who's got really big thighs or is quite heavy set, you look at them and you go, whoa, that's a player that is just going to bump someone and they're going to go flying. So it kind of celebrates, I think, more diverse body shapes and sizes. You might get a player who's quite short and they can really slinky themselves like underneath different types of bodies. Yeah. Or you might get someone who's sort of, you know, really muscular and really built and really tall. Tall players are kind of really valued as well. So it just depends. Can you roller skate and can you do good with what your body does? Yeah. And playing to your own personal strengths is definitely an advantage. So I never try to meet anyone and sort of decide whether they're going to be amazing or not. You sort of just watch them on roller skates and see how they go.
Nice one. Nick, can you skate?
You think I should, don't you?
I do.
You promised my mum you'd never bring this up again.
No, I didn't. Nick's got the most powerful quads you've ever seen.
Oh, this he is what we're be. Looking for.
He would be amazing.
Yeah.
He would be amazing. Given the power of Nick's quads, like, would you see him as a blocker or a
jammer?
Well, it depends. We'd have to get you out there and I'd probably have to hit you a few times. And
you've sold it so well.
Yeah. I was reading, like, just moments ago that there are over 1,250 leagues across the globe. Like, there are thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people participating. Mm. Do you know how it started in Texas?
I know some of the details. Mm. So from my knowledge, there was a man who sort of started the idea of roller derby on a banked track. And again, I think a lot of people sort of think of this image when they think of roller derby, similar to like a little velodrome. You've sort of got people skating around. However, it was quite sexualized. And players were often in sort of revealing clothing, or if they did a penalty that might have been planned, they might spin the wheel and there was sort of like pillow fight or things like that okay. The players needed to do.
Yep.
So I think that's sort of where it started. And then the players sort of said, hey, like, let's ditch this guy. We don't really need him, but this sport is super cool.
Yeah.
And then I feel like from there, that's when sort of the modern flat track roller derby started to emerge.
Yeah. You're saying it's a little bit like AFL in some respects, but AFL's played on grass and when you...
Not concrete.
No, that's right. It's got to hurt, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, falling down on concrete isn't the funnest thing in the world. So when we start out, you get taught how to fall safely and we're always in protective padding. So I wear knee pads, elbow pads, wrist pads, a helmet and a mouth guard.
Yeah.
And I actually have padded clothing as well to prevent from like corkies. So I wear padded shorts and like a padded sort of chest top as well. And that's really cork. Helpful. Cork. Yeah.
Oh, the cork thighs, yeah.
They're just the worst.
So what are the common injuries apart from corks and things like that?
A lot of ankles, just because you're falling in an awkward way. You might twist it or something. A lot of knee injuries as well. And sometimes shoulder injuries. And then over the past few years, we've been trying to, I think, as a sport, get a lot more aware of concussion as well and sort of have really good concussion guidelines and teach players when they start how to be mindful of like where your head is in time and space, because we're so close to one another that it can be a little bit risky. So my helmet actually has this cool, like very 90s RoboCop like face shield. So that sort of prevents any sort of fingers in the eyes or fingers up the nose.
And if our listeners want to actually envisage that, all they've got to do is look up Lauren Foote on Google and you can see that very helmet. It looks super cool.
Yeah, when we first got them, that was sort of a prototype and we kind of walked around the room making robot noses. But since then, I'm a big fan. I wear it kind of quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you could even rock that around the streets. It's that cool looking. Hey, tell us, as a kid, were you on skates as a two-year-old? Were you into sport? You know, were you hip and shouldering your younger or your older brother? Or yeah, how did – when you grew up, were you right into sport?
Yeah, I was always a really sporty kid. My parents actually met in the snow. So as a family, we were super fortunate that that was a big part of our lives. So I was on skis at about 3.
Right.
Mum tells me I cried quite a lot and we gave it another crack at 4. So I think in terms of skating skills, I probably developed a tiny bit of that from when I was a kid. However, once I started going to school, I got put into netball like most other girls my age.
Mm. Did you love netball?
I did actually. I still have a lot of friends who I met when I started playing netball when I was in prep, so probably about 5. So I've known them for quite a number of years. It was really, really fun. Mm. And I played it for like 15 years with the same team and it was a really fun kind of activity. However, you know, I still remember a lot of umpires saying, goal defence, calm down, goal defence, no, you cannot specky people. So I think I was destined for something a little bit more physical than netball.
It was in your blood early on.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a girl, as a female, what was your experience around opportunities in sport and I guess the equities or the inequities between boys and girls as you were growing up?
Yeah, so I probably first noticed the inequities between boys and girls when I got into high school. Mm. I was always a sporty kid trying to do every sort of sport that I could get my hands on. And one of those was soccer. Our little, you know, under 13, under 14s team, we actually did quite well. And we got through districts or divisions, whatever it was called back then. And the boys did too. So then we all progressed to the next stage. And this is when I noticed that the boys had a coach and the boys trained and the boys got the new uniforms and I realised that we didn't have a coach and we didn't train and we didn't have the good uniforms. We had the ones with the letters on the back that kind of peeled off and just like a really sad number 4. Mm. So I kind of wasn't cool with that. And the first step, we actually needed a teacher to take us to divisionals, which I believe was on a slightly different day to the boys. And our sport teacher said, oh, I can't, I've got something else on. I mean, what? I don't know what else a sport teacher had on, but
right.
They sort of said no. And I was like, oh, what are we going to do? Like, we can't pull out. So I start door knocking around and I think, oh, who else can I ask? The English teachers, no, they're busy, all right. So I keep knocking. And then I finally get to the science teacher. And by this time, I'd sort of got a bit of a spiel kind of underway. And I was like, oh, I think I can convince this science teacher, you know, compliment her on what she's wearing. So you look really nice today. Your science class is so great. Anyway, so I say, look, it's a day off. Like, we just needed someone to drive us. I said, I would drive us. Clearly, I do not have a license. I'm 14. So I finally convinced the science teacher to take us. And I don't think she'd ever driven a minivan in her life. I told her she didn't need a special license. Yeah. Could have been wrong. So off we went, this group of misfit girls off to state or divisionals, whatever it was. And, I think that journey, that process really put a fire in my belly because I was a bit angry. I was like, why do I have to go this extra mile just to get the same thing as what the boys have? Mm. And it was so clear to me. I could see all these things that they had and that I wanted. And in particular, you know, there's like little drink bottles that you like put in your chin and you sort of squeeze them. You don't, so everyone can kind of share one.
So you don't have to put your lips on the...
Yeah. I mean, we never had these in netball.
No.
And I was like, soccer, this feels like the time.
Yeah.
So I remember been in the storage sort of shed and seen those drink bottles and being told, oh, that they're for the boys. And I was just furious. I thought, I really want those drink bottles.
Isn't that ridiculous?
And I think that fire in my belly is still there, that I really would actually, even to this day, I'd love one of those drink bottles.
can we arrange one, Blake?
We sure can. Yes. It'll have Doolander branding all over it. But hey.
I think it'd be a hot item.
I think it might be. So even at that age, you were really aware of, you know, the haves and the have-nots when it came to the time, money and energy invested in boy sport versus girls sport. We'll come back to that because, you know, that plays a – there's a theme throughout your whole life and about knocking on people's doors and educating them on what they should be doing in terms of the energy that they're putting into girls and women's sport. As a teenager, you grew up in Wantirna, you're rocking around the Knox Shopping Centre with all your mates, and you're loving sport, you're super sporty. Was it clear what you wanted to do from a career perspective?
Not really. Like you said, I loved sport, and I think that was such a common theme throughout my life. And I do believe that the inequities and that fire in my belly, whether it was getting girls to participate in sport, because I absolutely noticed a big reduction in girls participating around that 14 age mark where, you know, it's easy to blame the individual girls and say, oh, why are you saying that you have your period? Why are you saying that you don't want to get sweaty today? Why are you saying that the sport's too hard? But I think that's too easy. I think there's a reason why they felt pressure that they couldn't be sweaty. There's a reason why they maybe were in, you know, pain if they were experiencing menstruation or the social pressures around what that actually means for a person's body and the social stigma if, you know, God forbid you were to bleed through your shorts or something like that.
Yeah.
So even from that age, I really just wanted to encourage people, like, it's okay, come and give it a go, like, let's do it, I'll be there for you. Oh, we've got a girls' corridor, like, that'll make the game a bit more even. So, yeah, I think young, I just love sport and I liked encouraging people to play it, and it's where I met a lot of my friends and it's where I connected with people. So it just seemed like the natural progression to become kind of like a sport teacher. So I guess that's sort of where I put my energy. And then as I sort of progressed through high school and looked at the different career pathways, I thought, oh, maybe I want to become a physio. Like, that sounds pretty cool. And maybe I could work with athletes, which 90% of physios want to do, and about 10% I think actually do.
Yeah.
So I ended up putting in all my applications, and while I didn't get into physio, I got into a Bachelor of Exercise Science, and that was a great starting point for, hey, if you like sport, go do this undergraduate degree and then you can kind of figure out the rest later. So that's kind of what I did.
Where'd you study?
I studied at Australian Catholic University.
Where's that?
In Fitzroy, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in 2011, the world opened up. You said, righto, I'm moving out of home. Your sister was living in the city somewhere and went and moved in with your sister, and the world became a really cool place.
Yeah, I ate a lot of mac and cheese.
Mac and cheese. Jeez, I love mac and cheese. Well, I'm vegan now, so I don't eat mac and cheese anymore, but jeez, I love mac and cheese.
Yeah, it was like not even the good stuff. It was like, remember that microwave one?
Out of the packet.
Just like added like a bit of water.
Yeah, and stir it around.
Yeah.
Minute 30, bang, there's your dinner.
Yeah, it's
living the high life.
Yeah. Student life.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be honest, a lot of that time I did feel like I had my big girl pants living with my sister. However, I had a lot of inner turmoil because I sort of was coming to figure out who I was, and I spent a lot of time inside my bedroom sort of not doing a lot and being a bit nervous about probably my sexuality and my identity, and I had all these expectations. All right, now you're out in the big world. Go and do the things. Go and be a grown up. And I was like, but I don't know who I am and I don't know if I can do this. So, yeah, it was a bit of a tricky time.
Mm. How did you overcome that? How'd you, you know, get yourself out of your bedroom and out in the big wide world? And
well, I bought a skateboard.
Wow.
And that definitely helped.
Yeah.
I felt really cool with my sick Sector 9 skateboard. So I'd skateboard down to uni and hang out with, I made some dorky friends, and we would sort of hang out the back of the uni and play around on my skateboard and hang out and ask ourselves questions that our university professor would always ask: what is exercise science? What is exercise science? And sort of contemplate the bigger things in life.
Right. What was it? What was the answer he was looking for?
I have no idea.
Clearly neither did he. Was it around this time that you saw a movie that changed your life?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. So I saw the film Whip It. Is that the one you were referring to earlier, Nick?
No.
Oh. I need to watch this.
I'm going to look up what it is whilst we we'll get there. It's it was a show about weird sports, and they did a little 30-minute thing on that.
Great.
Highland Games, that cheese rolling
one.
Oh,
yeah. Roller derby's not weird, mate. It's obscure. Mainstream. I don't think it's – would you describe it as obscure?
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you, Lauren. All right. Blake was trying to put me right in front of
I was throwing you in there.
I think that's one of its best qualities. So yeah. I watched this movie, Whip It, with the now Elliot Page and Drew Barrymore, and I was like – this is so cool. Like, what an amazing film. What a cool movie. Like, I just love everything about it. And my brother-in-law kind of like yells out from another room, "It's real." And I was like, "No, it's not. That's ridiculous. Like, absolutely not. This can't be real. It's like the coolest thing I've ever seen." So we had a big argument about it.
Yeah.
And then jumped on Google and saw that it is real and there's a club. Ah.
Home.
I'm seeing a video. Thank you. I'll have to check it out. So I we were kind of having a bit of a debate about whether this sport was real, and I logged on and saw this website called the Victorian Roller Derby League, and they were having like a grand final game next weekend. It was all very poetic, and they needed first aiders. So
You sent an email to, was it Thrasher or Bonnie the Destroyer or, you know,
someone with an equally menacing name.
Yeah.
And I was a bit sort of wondering what I've gotten myself into.
Yeah.
So I turned up to this sort of old shed at the dodgy end of Reservoir, and there's people like lined up all around wearing kind of like alternative clothing, and there was lots of hair gel and there was lots of black and earrings and cool music. So I felt very cool going to the front and being let in. And the players were already warming up, kind of skating around, and there were lots of cool clothing. And I remember the two teams playing were the Toxic Avengers and the Dead Ringer Rosies.
These are some unbelievable names.
Yeah. I love the creativity.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun, cool. Isn't it?
Yeah.
So I sit down at the first aid kind of seat next to another person who's obviously in the sport. And I'm just wide-eyed and kind of, whoa. And I turn to her and I'm like, what is happening? And she looked at me and goes, you're new. And explained the rules, and I think I fell in love right there and then.
You were saying earlier that that moment, that time, it felt like you found your community.
Yeah, there was something about watching such athleticism and watching so many different bodies and having such a kind of queer layer to it as well. Like it was just such a clearly queer, alternative, rebellious space. And I think, you know, women weren't being what society told them to be. They weren't being thin. They weren't being polite. They weren't being proper. They weren't, you know, being small. They're actually taking up a lot of space. They were unapologetically like, stuff you, get out of my way.
Or I'm going to crush you.
Yeah. And I think I was just really enamored by that confidence, and I wanted to know more. I was drawn to it.
Talk us through the moment where you had the confidence to tell your family really who you were and what made you up.
Yeah, so in terms of my sort of sexuality, I had, you know, joined a roller derby team at this stage, and I'd kind of met someone and had a girlfriend, and things were kind of going really well. And then I was like, I got to tell people what's going on. So what do? You hold a family dinner. I don't know anyone who's ever done that, but don't. Like, if you're thinking it was really awkward. Right.
So what you just, did you just ring them up and say, hey, we're having a family dinner?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did.
Was your family a family dinner type of family?
No. We sat at the good table. Like, we went into the dining room.
Right.
So I told my family, hey, I want to have a family dinner with everyone. And they're like, okay. So we're all sitting eating and there's like that quiet between the time of like, we're here at this random family dinner and you planned it. So like, what's going on? So I was just sitting there and I like said the sentence that I'd been rehearsing in my mind like this whole time. And I said, hey, thanks for coming to this family dinner, everybody. I've met someone and I want you to meet her. And I thought, oh, so clever, like so smooth, just like put it in there.
There it is, yeah.
And my dad just like keeps eating and like says, is she outside? And I'm like, no, but it's a girl. They're like, yeah. Cool, like what's her name? So it was this big sort of almost anticlimactic moment where I was just sort of met with a lot of love and support from my family, which was so great because I think even if you know that you're from like a progressive family or you know you're going to be accepted, there's just so much shame and otherness that happens to anyone who grows up a little bit different from the spectrum of what we're told is normal.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was a really kind of funny way to come out.
That is super cool. Did that change the way that you felt? Like once you had that conversation with your – in that such a smooth way with your family, did it change the way that you felt about you and the world and –
Yeah, I mean, I could be my true, authentic self. I could start to...
Every moment of every day.
Yeah, I could start to really occupy space as a gay person. Mm-hmm. And it felt great to put on that identity. That was one that I've been thinking about for so long, but I was really scared to put it on. So, yeah, it was really liberating, I think, to be able to do that. And I don't think I could have done it, not in the same way, if I hadn't had... such a supportive environment at sport where I was exposed to not just a, you know, queer person but queer people killing it and doing awesome stuff.
Mm.
And I hope now that people and kids growing up have more of those like visible role models, not just like the queer movie where like someone dies at the end, but actual like queer role models of people not just being typecast for their sexuality but like being a cool human and doing cool stuff.
That is super cool. And you do that today, don't you? And we'll come back to that because the work that you're doing around championing just that very thing is super cool. I'd love to go back to roller derby if we could. So you go to Vegas.
Yep.
With the team. So that's a pretty cool place to go and participate in roller derby and you find yourself in Hawaii. Well, tell us about that experience.
Yeah, so I meet some people at like RollerCon Down Under. So there's a few American coaches that
I love that exists.
I was just about to say RollerCon Down Under. What is that?
So RollerCon is a... multi-day event that's usually run in Vegas and it's run by Tisha Nirvana and they put together this amazing sort of tournament / event where people can come and learn how to skate better. They can go to seminars, they can party, they can hang out, they can meet people and it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So they ran one down in Australia which was just like awesome. So I went to that, had an amazing time, and then ended up meeting some of them in Hawaii when I went on kind of holidays. And I was sort of skating with them, and I was with my club of origin at the time, East Vic, and feeling like I'd kind of been performing really well there, and I was ready for the next challenge. And I remember Dish, who is this kind of like quiet spoken person and doesn't really give out compliments that easy, very kind of sort of chilled. She was like, you should join VRDL. You're pretty good. And that's kind of all I needed. I got that external validation from, I guess, an elder in the community and someone who'd been around the sport for a long time. And I had that little voice inside of me. It's like, oh, maybe I can do this. So, yeah, I got back from my trip and I said, thanks, East Vic. I'm going to transfer. And then, yeah, I joined at VRDL and kind of started my journey from there.
So you sat down with your old man and you said, you know, I'm going to set some goals here. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I called my dad. He's this really beautiful, calm man and always the person I kind of like to go to if I need a little bit of advice. Mm. And I said, Dad, I'm going to set some goals. Like, I've joined this awesome sport. I'm in love with it and I want to see, like, how good I can get. So I'm like, okay, so I just joined. So maybe in, like, a year I can maybe get onto, like, a travel team, like the B team, and maybe I'll join, like, the home teams for this year and just see how I go with that. And then within, like, a few months I'd sort of been put on the top 30, which is known as the A and the B team. And then I even got it invited, hey, would you like to come and travel with the A team? And I was just like so blown away. I was not expecting that. So I called up my dad and I was like, Dad, I've achieved all of my goals. He's like, good job, set some new ones. So I was at that point, I kind of got to really think, oh my God, like how, like what if I could be a really great player? What if I could be maybe on the leadership group of the A team? What if I could develop my skills in that way? And I guess some of those skills of encouraging people to play sport from my teenage years started coming through. And I'd, you know, been studying exercise science, so I had some skills in this area. So that's when I started to join the leadership team and just turn up as much as I could. And slowly, slowly, I did my time on the bench. I traveled around the world giving high fives and not getting much track time. And then eventually I got kind of tapped on the shoulder and asked, hey, we want you to have a position that's skating on the track. And in our team, you know, it's so hard to break into that. There's only 8 blockers who get a skating position in the whole team. So to be one of those was like a massive achievement. And then from there, the team just kept climbing the international rankings, you know. We're ranked in between 10 and 20 and then we'll crack the top 10 and we're just getting better and better. And that's sort of when things got exciting.
So I mentioned the volume of leagues across the globe. I said there was 1,250. The vast majority of those would come out of the States, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So when you think about the volume of the team gets better and better. Like Australia's like a minnow, isn't it, in comparison to the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that would play it in the States. Take us through the journey of the team, because you did some amazing stuff and it culminated in an absolutely amazing achievement when a bit like the Jamaican bobsled team. Take us through what happened.
Yeah, so we knew that we were a really remote team against some of the other teams we were playing. They had the opportunity to really play one another on a more seasonal basis. We sort of would train from January all the way up to our first tournament in May, where we'd travel to America, come back, and then we'd have, you know, a few months until playoffs in September, we'd travel back, and then a third time in November we'd go over for championships. So those were really the only games that we would get against other teams. And while we were in Australia, in Preston, where we train in a little leaky factory, we were all, you know, working full time and doing what we needed to do to support ourselves to pay for these trips. And just playing ourselves. So again and again and again, like one of my teammates, Scarlett, we joke about it now. We've just had so many years of playing against one another, like every training session, that some days I'm like, Scarlett, I cannot with you right now. We're like sisters. So it's really quite emotional to play against your own team, which you know is the best in the world. You're like, this is really hard because this is one of the best athletes in the world that I'm up against. So, yeah, we made a commitment. Let's just train hard and do it as much as we can against one another. and come up with different strategies, because our benefit is that we're an unknown. People don't see us play as much. So we'd turn up to these American tournaments and just pull out these strategies that no one had ever seen before. And from there, that sort of started to develop our legacy of being a great team for defense, of being, you know, a team that's really strict with how we play sort of our jammers. And then we started to get coaches that did stats for us and that could understand like when to play a certain jammer, when to play a certain pack. That pack has good stats against that jammer. And it really started to kind of, everyone was doing their 10% to up the game. And that makes a big difference when you kind of all pull together. So in 2015, we lost in the semifinals of the World Championships.
Where was that played?
That was in, oh, it might have been, I think it was maybe Portland.
Okay.
2015. And then 2016, we again lost by 2 points in the semifinals against Rose City. And you know, heartbreaking to train so hard like that. You're training like 4 nights a week. You're doing gym as well. You're working full time. Like, it's a lot. So the next year, 2017, there was just this energy where everyone said, this is the year. Like, let's do it. So everyone was just working their hardest, and we invested in, you know, the team culture. We invested in the strategies. We're working together. And notable, we got a new transfer, Shayna Sarrelson, who had won a Hydra trophy from a Portland team.
Right. Was she an American or?
Yeah. So right. She transferred over. She was okay. In a relationship with one of our players
yeah.
and moved to Australia. And we're like, yeah, we'll take you. Like,
you bet we will, yeah.
So one of the notable, you know, factors was her brilliance and her brain. And she is just such a natural born leader. And she'd won a Hydra. So the team just had so many things aligned, and we worked hard, we worked hard, we worked hard. And I told my mum, I said, look, I think you should come to championships this year. So she was up in the stands in Philadelphia. It was just, you know, a big crowd, and we'd made it through kind of every round. We're in the grand final game. Oh, I don't know how many people you'd have there. It wasn't a full stadium, but it'd be like hundreds of people, I think. Like, it's hard to hear at times,
yeah.
We found, just being on the track. So you'd have to be careful with how you communicate to one another. And we, like, set up for our opening play. And the other team, Rose City, you know, they're 3-time champions. Like, of course, they're expected to win. And we set up and we put like 8 blockers on the track. And you're only allowed 4. So everyone's like, what are you doing? And we think, yeah, this is our smart strategy. Like, we're going to really mess with your head. And then they put out 8 blockers on the track. And we're like, oh, they've been practicing this move. So there's this real moment of chicken. And we look and I'm like, this is the real pack. That one's a fake one. And like 5 seconds gets called. And everyone kind of moves into position. And the next minute the whistle's blown and our jammer pops out of the scrum, and I just went, oh, I got a good feeling about this game. So it's interesting kind of how much those moments matter for your psychological energy. And yeah, we won that championship game and became the world champions. It was pretty cool.
That is amazing. Oh, goosebumps.
Yeah.
You took me there. You took me right. That sounds amazing. You talked about, like, that's a truckload of work that you're putting in. Like, you said you're training 4 days a week. How many weeks of the year?
Oh, like, when do we stop? Oh, my God. You do preseason in January and the world title's in November. So,
all year. Wow.
It's pretty full on.
That is full on. And you were talking about the changes in the culture of the team. Like, what? Describe the culture of the team when you won that championship.
I think there was just a lot of love and trust within the team. We invested in mindfulness together. So in between some training sessions, we would sit and do like a visual of that exact kind of jam that I described. I'd visualize that for 6 months before I did it. And it really made a difference to kind of instill that confidence in me, not only as an individual, but within the spoken meditation that our coach Andrea did. She also spoke about, you know, the trust that I had for my teammates and knowing that they had that and I had that. So I think investing in, we had a session with Rudy, a sports psychologist who happened to just like work in the gym next door to our venue, and we just like met him one day and was like, hey, he goes, whoa, what's going on here? You're a world championship roller derby team. Let me do a session with you. So he did a team building session. And yeah, we just invested in sort of giving feedback to one another in a really kind way, because it wasn't going to work if I'm playing against Scarlett all the time and then I'm kind of getting all snappy with her. So we kind of tried to develop ways of closing our sessions where we still do this today. We sit in like what's called a love circle, and you get given usually like two topics, and it's usually something you did well, something someone else did well, without any disqualifiers. So a disqualifier would be me saying, I think today that I did well at blocking, and someone would actually, we invited everyone to correct us. Whoa, 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 try again. Oh, today I did well at blocking. And it was that lovely encouragement from a teammate. And then even just to say those words, it really makes a difference in your confidence. And it's pretty special now that I get to kind of introduce new players to that strategy of positive reflection. And we got that off, I think, the Australian or the New Zealand rugby team did that, and that's where we got that idea. So it's something that we still do today, and opening and closing sessions I think is really paramount to team culture.
That is super cool. I reckon you and I need to get in a love circle, mate, and give each other some feedback about this podcast. But anyway, that is such a – like, that's just a beautiful place to be with a bunch of people that you can – share that experience with. Sounds amazing. Were you captain?
I think so. I think so.
You know so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was.
No disqualifiers.
Thank you. I was.
So you're not only the best team in the world, but you're leading the best team in the world. Was that ever on the goal list with your dad?
I don't think it was, actually. Right. Yeah, I don't think it was. Like we always wanted to beat the best teams in like Gotham, which I'm sure you can guess is from New York, and Rose City from Portland. Like they were always revered as some of the best teams in the sport. So I remember like in 2016 when we beat Rose for the first time, it was just overwhelming to kind of have that moment of undeniable facts that I can do this. And I think sport really provides people with that as the evidence to say you just did it, and I know you didn't think you could, but what else can you do? So it's really quite enticing to, I guess, have that little voice say, well, yeah, what can you do?
That is super cool. So at 14 you were championing girls sport and ensuring that it had the right level of focus, attention, commitment. Tell us about your discussion with Bridie O'Donnell.
So I first met Bridie when she came to our Hydra party, except I wasn't as cool as knowing who she was, which is a bit embarrassing now. So I went up to her. I'd done a speech sort of thanking everyone for coming, and I knew that there would be persons of interest there and the local community and the local council and whatnot, and we revealed the big trophy. And I went up to her and said, hi, I'm Lauren, nice to meet you, how are you going? She said, hi, I'm Bridie O'Donnell. I said, great, what do you do? So she explained
that. I'm guest speaker.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. She said, oh, well, I'm actually the head of the Office for Women in Sport, and we've just started this new initiative called Change Our Game, and I got invited here to celebrate your amazing win. And my jaw sort of dropped. I was like, the office of what? There's an office for women in sport? How do I work here? So I just became pretty obsessed. And the next day I kind of mustered up all this courage. And I remember where I was sitting. I was at work, and at the time I was working for a youth mental health hospital. And I said, I just have to email her, and I don't know what about, but I have to get amongst this. And I'm really proud that I did that, because after emailing her and saying, look, this is what I do and this is who I am, and I want to get involved with this Office for Women in Sport, I have to, it's like part of who I am.
Yeah.
And she got back to me and said, oh, do you want to be an ambassador? And I was like, yes. I had no idea what that meant. So since then, I've been really fortunate enough to be working in that space and championing for gender equity in sport.
That is amazing. Just, it's a theme, isn't it? You were meant to do that. Talk to us about, it's a new role at Proud to Play.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like a made-up role. So if I tell my friends about this job, they kind of laugh and they're like, nobody thinks this is real. So Proud to Play is a not-for-profit organization that helps LGBTIQ people and benefit their lives through the power of sport. So when I tell my friends, I'm like, hey, I just do gay stuff and sports stuff now. They're like, no, that's what you do for fun. I was like, yeah, but I get paid now. So part of my new role there is working on any grants that we get or any partnerships or just really connecting the queer community through the power of sport. And in turn, we know that from an evidence-based perspective, a lot of people from this rainbow community might have had a negative experience with sport. There's a lot of homophobia in sports, a lot of transphobia. And for myself, coming from a sport that welcomes trans and gender diverse people from a grassroots all the way up to an elite level, it's just so normalized in me now to talk about my pronouns and to be welcoming of people that come from different gender expression and from different sexualities. So for me, it's a real personal passion because we know that we can save lives doing this kind of work. And think about how hard it was for me to come out to my family.
Yeah.
I'm a cisgendered, white, able-bodied, middle-class woman. I'm really privileged. I have so much power in the world. I look at the amazing accomplishments that I achieved. Maybe that wouldn't have been the same story if I was a person of colour or if I had a disability or if I was trans and my parents kicked me out. So I feel like I have this gift inside of me to kind of help this community. And we're sort of talking about this yesterday where I said, you know, it costs a lot of energy to do this work, but I can't imagine where else I'd be putting my energy. So, yeah, I feel a strong passion towards, on a lighter note, you know, gay stuff and sport, but on a deeper level, it feels good in my heart. And this is the kind of work that I just feel really grateful to be able to do.
It's a beautiful thing. Hey, we're going to finish off with, you know, when you're talking to elite sports people, you'll often hear interviewers give them the fast five. I think we've got a fast six here. So tell us, Lauren, the greatest skating name that you've ever heard. By the way, what was yours? What is yours?
Yeah, my name was Screw Barrymore, which
Screw
I think is pretty cool.
Barrymore. Of course it was.
Yeah. I like Lady Trample. It's one of our skaters that was in our club. And there was a Punani Tsunami, which you can't really forget.
No, you cannot forget that. The hardest hit you've ever taken.
Oh, more than on one occasion, I get like a really big hit right in the guts and you absolutely pee a little bit. Like there's no way to control it.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What about the hardest hit you've ever given?
Oh, goodness me. The dream hit as a blocker, I think, sometimes is like when a jammer thinks that they've exited the pack and you hunt them down and you hit them out and you draw them back and you kind of have that little like kind of swagger about you.
Yeah.
So I've had one of those hits, which felt pretty good.
Wow.
And this is why I don't want to take to the track with you. You're just not going to
hunt you down. Do you have a pre-game ritual?
I was thinking about this. Not really. However, I used to change my wheels a lot. And I think that's probably an anxiety thing where I needed like the perfect wheels for the perfect surface because not all concrete is equal. However, I think these days I more so try to just have fun. And for me, it takes me out of serious mode where I put more pressure on myself. Yeah. So if I just connect and be a bit social and listen to a bit of good music, that kind of helps me get in the mood.
Like it.
I got a quick question about equipment, especially the skates. Is it like bike riders and the people are very finicky about their gear?
Yeah, I'm nodding. Yeah, absolutely. So down to the like the cushion that joins your truck to your plate and, you know, the type of wheels and the bearings that you have and the laces. Yeah, definitely. We get really particular.
And like some people have 35 bikes hanging in their garage, you got a fair swag of skates?
I have three sets of roller skates. Yeah. I usually would travel with two pairs because the last thing you want to happen is like a plate would break and then you're sort of out for the game.
Yeah.
But I'm very fortunate that I received sponsorship through a skate shop, so I kind of had access to that. But I think a lot of people, you know, because we're already paying a lot of money to travel, they sort of have what they had, and then, you know, we'll put some duct tape around it and get you back out there.
Any superstitions on game day, game night?
Not particularly, I don't think. Oh, I did have a special pair of socks. The ones that I won, the championship game, they have a hole in them now, but I like tried to sew it up and I just still wear them. So, yeah, they're my special socks for
favorite
sure.
Favorite socks. When you're feeling overwhelmed and you're under a ton of pressure, what do you do?
Yeah, I'm definitely an anxious person, and sometimes I think it's good because it helps like perpetuate me to do lots of things, but then I am very, very busy and get kind of very tired and just sort of conk out. For me, it's been about finding meditation. So I guess I try to take like 3 deep breaths if I need like a micro reset, and usually that helps sort of shift something. But yeah, I've been trying to kind of journal and do a bit of daily movement and stuff like that. So yeah, that's what I do to de-stress.
Cool. Last one. If you could change something in sport today with a click of your fingers, what would it be?
For me, it would be equal access of pathways for boys and girls. Like, girls are 50% of the population and yet they're not kind of getting the same access, and I think that'll help really forecast the changes that we need to see within other marginalised groups. So yeah, I think a big commitment from major state sporting associations and major clubs. We saw it in cricket where the men's team said, nah, this isn't okay, the women need to be paid equally. And I think AFL has a lot of progress they need to make in that regard, and I think other sports can kind of step in that direction as well. So, yeah, I'd like to see it to actually be a viable option to become a female athlete as a job. Yeah. that would be what I would want.
Cool. There is one more question. Sorry, I'll just keep on coming up with questions. Have you met with your dad lately and said, hey, I need another goal-setting session, and what's on that list?
No, and what a great idea. With COVID, I think we're all just really discombobulated. We've returned to skating now, which is so fortunate because we have so many other clubs in the world, and particularly America, who are very far beyond skating. For me, we did have a team meeting actually the other week, and I have a little post-it note that's above my coffee machine, and it says 3 things on it. The top one says, work on breaking up seams as a jammer, which is like in between two people's bodies. The second one is have fun. And the third one is, I can't remember.
Hey, I reckon that's a great way to wrap this up. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to Nick and I today. You said that it costs a truckload of energy to do what you do. We just hope that energy never dissipates, because you've got a gift. You've been doing it all your life, and we really hope you continue to really champion the cause and grow that community that sounds so amazing. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Lauren.
Delightful. Loved every moment of that chat with Lauren.
Yeah.
Got a lot out of it too, personally, and we'll touch on that in a minute. But I had a really pressing question for you.
What's that?
Well, Lauren talked about the people in the team, and they've got these crazy, amazing names.
Yeah.
Like, one of my favourite was Kitty Decapitate. So if you were lining up in the team tomorrow, what would your name be?
Well, I guess just to carry on a theme that we've had for the whole series thus far, it probably has to be something to do with my legs, doesn't it, Blake?
Probably does, yeah.
How about Quadzilla?
Nick, Quadzilla Davidus. Yes.
It could work.
That would work.
What would you be?
Well, I have all of it. Like, I don't like this.
Oh, that's a great way to start.
I don't like this name, but I'm going to go with Blake the Snake Collins. Well, I think my role
would be as a jammer
yeah.
and just slip in
yeah.
through the cracks.
I don't think you can oil yourself up before a match, but yeah, that kind of works. Do you reckon you'd be a jammer or a blocker?
Back in the day, when I was 12 years old, all I wanted for Christmas was a pair of speed skates. My mum and dad got me some speed skates, and I spent a lot of time at Caribbean Rollerama, really, really going as hard as I possibly could. Loved it. So, you know, that explosive bit of speed, that's for me for sure.
Yeah, okay.
And if I am oiled up, straight through.
The yeah, so there goes the snake again.
Yeah, there he is.
Yeah.
And I just sort of make a little sizzle sound as I go, as I go through.
That's a bit of flair. Yeah, I can see you doing that.
Right there.
How good's Lauren though?
She's amazing. One of the things that I took away from her chat was, and there were many, I'll start with, she said that it costs a lot of energy
yeah.
to do what she does. Mm. And it's all worth it though.
Yeah.
She's passionate about building that community. She's passionate about the cause that she's fighting for, passionate about being an ambassador for women in sport. And yes, it does cost a lot of energy when you're trying to do and build all of those things, but absolutely every bit of it's worth it.
That's a good lesson in there for people.
I loved that she sat down with her old man.
Yeah.
And set some goals. Just, I'm going to have a crack at doing this, this and this. And you know, it's just such a one, they've got a great relationship, obviously, but just being able to tick off those girls along the way.
She needs to set a new list now.
She does. The other thing that I loved is, like, this sport has taken her around the globe.
Yeah.
She's been over to Vegas.
But they're paying their own way. We need some sponsors for that team.
We do need. So, if there's anybody that's out there that would love to sponsor Lauren's team, they should hit us up, send us an email.
Howdy@thedolanders.com. And we'll get you in touch with Lauren.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be cool? Get him some game day sponsorship. Love it. What else did you get? I mean, what did you get out of this, Quadzilla?
I love learning about the sport and then obviously love hearing, you know, how people came to be, what their life's journey was. And I just think the positive attitude that she brought to this, you know, we hadn't met her. We only knew her through a third connection. She obviously is passionate about the sport. She's proud of who she is and the things that have made her into the person she is today. Only very young still, the things that are in front of her that she's probably not even considering, doors will open for her. They probably already have opened for her and she's doing an incredible job. I just love the story.
Yeah.
She was a joy to have.
She was. And I think the last one, as you touched on, she's wandered into this community and looked around, sat down on that plastic seat as I think a first aider when she first arrived and went, these are my people. This is the community that I belong in. And feeling part of that community gave her some of the courage that she needed to actually come out and have that conversation with her family,
which
she invited to dinner and went on to, you know, tell them about her being gay. And I just love the fact that she found a place where she felt comfortable enough that gave her the impetus to share who she is with the world.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great story.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that one, listeners. And, Nick, who have we got on next week?
Next week, of course, is episode 35.
Yes.
And that is the CEO of Intrepid Travel, James Thornton.
This will be, is, a fascinating chat. And if there was any industry that has been affected by COVID, it's the aviation and the travel industry. It's a fascinating chat. Look forward to seeing you next week and get that broken body of yours fixed.
Yeah, I'll try. See you, Dolanders.